Welcome to episode 37 of the Nerdstravaganza podcast, a cultured podcast, yet one that is down to earth. I'm Tom.
I'm Rick.
I'm Ryan.
And we have a highly culturally relevant episode for you this evening. How are you, gentlemen?
I'm fine and cultured.
I'm sick as a dog.
As I've hinted at, we've had a very culturally relevant experience lately, and tonight's episode focuses on that, that being a trip to the museum to view the Art of Video Games exhibit that was on display there. But before we jump into that topic matter, it's time to share with you all of the... Oh, what's a synonym of culture to describe all the great things we've been doing in the past week, guys?
Weekly and Geekly!
Weekly Geekly, that is synonymous with cultured. What weekly geekly things have we been up to? Why don't you go first this time, Brian, since you pretty much always do?
I don't have a lot to report, man. All I did was play Tokyo Jungle and Borderlands this week.
I disagree. Those are both things to report.
Ah, but it doesn't make for a long segment. What did we unlock? We unlocked the sheep?
Yeah,
Now we can headbutt things.
The sheep, and we were kicking the crap out of stuff with the black buck.
Oh, yeah, we did. Unlock an elk-like being that I've never heard of before that literally kicks bunnies across the screen. I thought that was a lot of fun.
We were getting clean kills. If you pounce on an enemy, catch him unawares, and take him down, you get a clean kill, like, thing that flashes up on the screen. So imagine this herbivore getting clean kills on fucking jackals and stuff. Yeah, it was awesome. Go ahead, Brian. Your update, though. Please continue. Anything else?
Borderlands. Getting more into it. Got the season pass. Kind of peeked at one of those, but decided not to start it without friends. Enjoying it a lot more. I think it was the low-level generalness of it. All my guns were the same, and all my skills hadn't been fleshed out yet. So about level 15, I started like actually feeling like a soldier instead of a sniper. At least more than I was. Still not quite as unique as the first game, I feel.
Yeah, there's a little too... It's a little on the generic side, and it's sad that like the bumper... prompts between screens even tell you, hey, just because you're a soldier doesn't mean you shouldn't use a sniper rifle. Like, they're kind of encouraging everybody can do anything, aren't they?
A little bit.
But a solid game.
And the quirky jokes, the humor kind of, like, poked its head around, finally. That's kind of what I was looking for.
I'm glad you're appreciating that. Even some of the things the NPC, or the enemies say as you kill them. The guy you light on fire.
I smell delicious!
Yeah, I smell delicious. That's pretty cool. Awesome, man. Does that conclude your brief but impactful roundup? Okay. Over to you, Ricky. What you been up to?
Wanting to smash my controllers because Epic Mickey's a fucked up game. I listened to last week's podcast, and of course, by the end of my rant, I was calmed down until I picked up the controller again and then realized that I was justifiably aggravated.
Oh, no.
There's just a lot of stuff in the game that makes it feel broken, man. And I don't know, I had a thought originally it was because I didn't play the first one, but after doing some research, realized that's not really the case. There's just a lot of stuff that isn't explained, and I'm all for accidentally finding cool stuff in a game, but cool stuff that needs explanation in order for it to be done properly or even useful in general really should be in the game design, not just something that you got to go buy a Prima guide for. But, you know, above and beyond that, there's some very clunky controls in it that I feel if I was playing co-op with somebody else, I wouldn't have these issues. Like, you gotta call Mickey over, or when you're playing as Mickey, you gotta call Oswald over by pressing your B button on the Xbox, right? So, he comes over, and then depending on what he can do, it's like the AI understands the circumstance. Okay, well, we wanna use my... Oswald's remote control to zap this fuse box and it will turn something on or turn something off, whatever the case may be. So these little thought balloons pop up over their head and then you hit B to go ahead and make that happen. Most of the time that works, but not all the time. There's times where you can get it to do it once, and then if you don't do what you're supposed to do in that level... Which, these are open game levels, like, you're not supposed to, they're not linear, you're not really supposed to do them, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So, there may be, perfect example, I'm on this bog level, there's some frogs that are sitting on the sideline, and you gotta zap the frogs, and then they stop shooting thinner, which thinner erases stuff, so The dock planks are getting erased, and they're too wide, so you can't jump them. So you're supposed to grab Oswald, zap the frog. The frog stops spitting thinner. You paint in the walkway, and you're good to go. After X amount of time, the frog unzaps and starts spitting again. Well, once that happens, you would think you're just supposed to grab Oswald and zap that frog again.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, sometimes you can, sometimes you can't. It's just totally random, whether it feels like doing it or not. There was another case where I thinned out this big chunk of wall, and there was a floating treasure chest in there. And one of Oswald's tricks is, in co-op with Mickey, is you call him over, and again, the game knows what to do, so a thought bubble will appear above his head, showing that, you know, hey, Mickey, if you want me to throw you, press the B button. So I'm sitting there, and I keep calling him over, but he'll only come as far as to where the wall that I have erased exists. He won't pass that barrier. One time he went in there, but right after he threw me, I missed it, and then he never came back in again. And I restarted the game. I kept mashing B. So just, like, frustrating things like that. But there are parts of the game that I absolutely love. And I think that once I get back from my trip to California and stuff, I'm just going to... I ordered my Prima Guide already online. And for these times that I get frustrated, I'm not going to piss myself off. I will just simply look it up and be like, okay, that's because it's a co-op thing. Or it's because... it wasn't explained. I'm not going to beat my head against the wall for it. But on top of all that, really what I'm going to do, I'm going to play co-op with Kimberly. So there'll be no excuses left. And then I can have a true review of the Epic Mickey 2 game. But there are parts of it that are just so... I just love it. And then other parts that I just want to fucking kill myself.
Yeah. Find a mode of play that lets you just love the parts you love, I think. It sounds like you're there's just some bad, like, ally use artificial intelligence going on there.
Yeah.
That's ruining the game for you.
Yeah, that and some bad camera. But, you know, I kind of got through the confusion. I'm in a spot now where I can jump around from place to place. So I just would have, you know, a little guidance of letting me know that I wasn't going mental would have been nice. So I'm a little bit closer along and a little bit further away than I was last time, if that makes any sense.
Yes.
So to supplement my aggravation in that, I've also been playing a couple other games. I started playing Lego Star Wars, the complete saga for the Nintendo DS.
Yeah.
So I cracked that open, started playing from where I left off, was totally lost, erased my game and started over. So I've been having a blast playing that again. I actually play that while I edit the shows. It's pretty fun. So that's nice. My DS time. And then I have a couple gems that I got off of Xbox. One of them being an indie game, 80 points, so basically a buck. It's a game called Little Acorns. And you play as a quirky little squirrel who runs around. It's a platformer game. You run around and you collect acorns. And once you collect all the acorns, then you can run around and collect fruit on all of these platformy levels. And there's little spiders that you got to avoid. And you kind of got to mash it up between, do I want to go for more points and more collected stuff? Or do I want to get a better time? So there's a couple different ways you can play. And then once you've stored up enough acorns in your tree, which is like the in-between levels, it shows you how many you've collected and stuff. You can spend those on little outfits for your squirrel. It's a really stupid game. It's a really stupid game put out by Team Pesky. But it's fun. And for a buck, it's got really good controls. It doesn't feel like a lot of the dollar games that, you know, feel shitty, but you excuse it because they're only a buck. This one actually is... It was a good, you know, $5 game. It's definitely playable. Definitely some skill went into it, art-wise and programming-wise. So definitely nice. Thumbs up on that. And then another one that I just grabbed tonight, actually, is called PID, or P-I-D, I'm not sure. But it's a story of a young boy named Kurt who finds himself stranded on a peculiar planet, and he must find his way home, finding help from unlikely aliens and curious tools in his backpack. Kurt must use gravity-defying beams to conquer every platform and solve every puzzle in this strange journey, featuring over 12 hours of action-adventure gameplay.
I love the way you're reading that.
This feels a lot like Limbo, same type of feel of the game, like a ominous, not as creepy, not as dark, not as scary, but definitely just the whole way the game plays, it feels like that. So I'm digging on that one, and that's 800 points. I haven't bought it. I'm still playing the demo. I might buy it. We'll see. And that was by a developer called Might and Delight. D3 publisher. But yeah, so that's my two new Xbox treasures that I've found. And I'm taking them both. So we'll link those in the show notes and all that good stuff.
Please do, for my benefit. I may have to check these out.
Yeah, so that does it for my roundup. Just some long-winded Xbox rant, I guess.
Not a rant. A very informative discussion of gaming, I would say. In line with tonight's episode. I guess it is now my turn, and I will run through a couple of bullet list things and then linger on one of my roundup items before we get into the main topic matter. Okay, I've been playing some Final Fantasy 13, decided to finally take a plunge into an a proper RPG, or what is, I think, inappropriately labeled a JRPG. And Final Fantasy 13 is the first Final Fantasy game I've visited in a while, and it seems so far very linear and very like I'm an actor in a movie with a script and scenes, and I'm just kind of along for the ride. The combat system is somewhat intricate, so there is something to be said for that, but there's not a lot of exploration. There's no wandering around. It's you're literally just walking down one path through a gorgeous environment after another. And not used to such an on-rails experience from my Final Fantasy games or from my RPGs in general. So,
what system?
So, no, sorry. I'm playing that on the PlayStation 3. It did get a release on the 360 as well. I just felt like the PS3 was the more natural home for the game, and it's alleged to look a little bit better on the PS3 because it was initially supposed to be an exclusive, and then they decided, well, there's a huge market on the Xbox 360 that we better not pass up. So it was released on both systems. Anyway, gorgeous game, I will say that, and I'll withhold my final impressions till I get it might be a while until I finally, you know, make my way through the game or most of the game.
You've encountered a Marquis yet.
A Marquis?
Marquis.
Is it pronounced Marquis at some point?
I don't remember which game it was. I think it was 11 or 12. Or it must have been 12, because 11 was the MMO, right?
Yes, but it was 12. Somebody said Marquis. Oof.
Marquis de Sade?
Exactly. I might go back and revisit 12 if I make it through 13, because that was the last one on the PS2, if I'm not mistaken. Wouldn't mind checking that out.
He's gonna go back in time.
I want to play the Marquis game offered on the... Oh, terrible.
I recommend playing it subtitled. If you can, I don't even remember. I think I just stopped after hearing that.
I should see if that option exists in 13, but 13, the voice acting's been good enough, apart from a couple of mess-ups in the way lines were delivered, that I can tolerate it, so it's cool. Let's see, aside from Final Fantasy 13, I have continued in Super Mario Bros. U. I'm, of course, not just blasting through that game on the Wii U. I'm trying to find all of the big mega coins. Brian has helped me by playing in boost mode with me a couple times, but in addition, I've uncovered a number of coins on my own. So I've been pretty good about getting all the coins before I press on to the next level. It's delaying my progress in the game, but I feel more complete as I make my way through the game. I feel more of a sense of completion, I should say. I've also been playing some Borderlands 2 with Brian, as he mentioned. He got me back into it. I got him the game for Christmas, and then we've been playing it. And I went in with my assassin. Is it assassin now? Yeah, I played with that guy, and he was overpowered for Brian's campaign, so I used my special, like, Insiders Club code I got for pre-ordering to unlock the Mechromancer class, which is the little girl with the robot. Started playing her in Brian's game, and have quickly leveled up to the point where I can now hang in his game. I should note that, like, no sooner had I redeemed that code so far long after buying the game than the very next day they made her free, so...
Yikes.
Did they make her free?
Yeah, I believe she's like free DLC now. I think so, anyway. It might just say that because I'm part of the Insight, or, you know, the pre-order club, but check when you go in. I think they might have made her free content. I hope not. I hope it's just telling me that because I am, because I already own the rights to her. But we'll have to double check that. Anyway, playing some of that, it's good. She's cool. It's cool having the big robot I can send out to do my fighting for me. I'm looking forward to playing some of the new downloadable content packs that came out for that game, so hopefully we'll be coming back with an update on how we enjoy those coming episodes. A little more Polar Bears Cafe, of course. That show continues to deliver the hilarity that I've come to expect. Rick, you have got to get into that show so we can talk about it.
After LA, as soon as I come back, because I don't want to get the free demo, you know, the free trial period, and then spend half of it out of town. So
I got it. I got it. Makes sense. I started playing a game called Code of Princess for my 3DS. Very cool, sort of sword and sorcery beat 'em up in the vein of Guardian Heroes or that type of game. It's really cool. I've actually been playing my 3DS fairly consistently since starting that game. It's really awesome. And just a simple two-button smash 'em up type of game that a simple guy like me can get into. And reading an old, I guess, trade version of a DC miniseries from the mid to late 90s called Kingdom Come, which is... no. It's not what it sounds like.
All I think of is the Disney princess in porno form. I don't know why.
Yeah, I can see how the title could take you there. This is actually about like the older generation of superheroes who've kind of relinquished their power and retired and allowed like a bunch of like misfit, like the next generation, they don't have such a straight moral compass. So I think it's all building up to them having like kind of a civil war, you know, a super or meta human civil war, if you will. The art in this is absolutely fantastic. It gets a solid recommendation for me, even though it's what, 15 years old or something like that. So 18 years old, whatever. That's it. That's my update.
Tommy's going back in time.
Yeah, I've spent a lot of time. Appropriate that you should say that, though, Rick, because we, the Nerdstravaganza podcast, took an artistic walk back in time when we visited the Art of Video Games exhibit at the nearby Boca Raton Museum of Art, if I'm not mistaken. That is the name of the venue, yes?
Yes. Well, it's an art museum in Boca Raton, so that's close enough.
Yeah, I don't know. It might have been named, you know, like the McCrory Museum or something. And
no, you got it.
You know, we put on some turtleneck sweaters and berets and had long filtered cigarettes, and in we walked to criticize the offerings therein.
Did you really walk in to criticize, or is that just the ironic art talk?
I think like you are you not supposed to like criticize art? Like you can't just enjoy it. You have to
critique.
Oh, critique? Yeah. I'm sorry.
Yes.
Is that just French for criticize? Or
depends if you got a black and white striped shirt on with your beret or not.
Brian, you're the what, grammarian, if that's the right word among us. Does critique just mean criticize?
I mean, there's positive critiques, so I wouldn't say in English it does. I don't know the base, like the Latin etymology or anything.
Okay. Well, whatever you're supposed to do, we were there to do it. And I'd like to get your impressions of the exhibition. Is it an exhibit or an exhibition? I'm gonna need so much grammar check. We're in such culture territory that I'm gonna have to go to Brian for like grammar checking, like all episode.
An exhibition.
Yes. So there we were at an exhibition. And what did you guys think? General impressions.
It was not at all what I expected. I really liked it more than I expected to, because when I read it, I guess it was just the way I read it. I heard the art of video games, not the art of video games. So I was expecting it to be like, you know, dev photos and you know, art inspired by this or whatever, you know, like artist renders and everything.
Yep.
And I was really pleasantly surprised that a museum, well, several museums, it was just the one that we were at, treated it as video games are really and truly art.
Yeah, the art of video games is in the art of fighting as opposed to the art contained in the video games. Yeah. How about you, Ricky? Do you concur? Was that the way you...
Sadly, it was exactly what I expected it to be, and feel like it was a flop on all fronts.
Sadly? And a flop. Wow. We'll have to dig into that. I'm more with Brian. I was expecting them to spend a lot of time... I was expecting it to focus on... You know, in the early days, graphical limitations, you know, were such that games could only look like this, and then games looked like that, and then later and later. But they didn't really focus so much on the technique. They focused on the finished products as pieces of art, I guess. And I was pleasantly surprised by that. I didn't really have any expectations, so all in all, I thought it was good.
Have either of you guys been to any other type of either video game art exhibit or... a collective, any type of traveling show that showcases video games outside of the pinball expo that we go to every year?
Yeah, that's the only one.
So basically think of something that's either at an art museum or a science museum, anything like that.
Oh, I don't think so.
Yeah, other than whatever that thing was, the interactive thing was at Epcot years ago. I can't say I've ever been to anything like this.
Okay.
So you think that colors our perception of this exhibition?
No, it was just curious because I've been to one. The one that stands out in my mind is Videotopia, and it was basically a traveling show that went from different science museums all around the United States and featured dozens and dozens of old school video games, cabinet arcade games. So it's basically like a traveling arcade based on the history of arcade games. And aside from having all the cabinets there for you to play and see how things progressed and stuff like that, they also had a bunch of original hardware, prototype machines, artwork, you know, the actual graph paper that Jarvis guy used to design Defender on and stuff that. I mean, a lot of really cool shit that, sadly, I found missing at a show like this. Not just the prototypey stuff, but...
That's actually kind of what I was expecting.
Yeah, and, I mean, I kind of knew in advance that it wasn't going to be like that, but the complete omission, 100%, of arcade games when you're talking about video games, it wasn't the art of home video game consoles...
You know, you're right. They,
I don't want to blow my load, but I think the general statement for me is it wasn't enough about art, it wasn't enough about history, and it wasn't enough about technology. And some of those, they completely skipped over altogether.
Okay, there's a lot in what you said there, but I think to sum up what the exhibition was, that the art of video games could have been renamed the art of console video games, those consoles being that which followed the prehistory, which was the arcade era. There. I think that might be another way to put it, because the arcade was mentioned here and there as like a, either to compare the technology of each specific era with what was available in the arcade, or arcades were mentioned as something to harken back to, like, oh, back when arcades were the only game.
Yeah, I noticed it most when they were talking about the Atari 2600. They kind of alluded to the crossover that was the beginning. They never said it, but they definitely alluded to it, where they were talking about how home users got, you know, this version of Pac-Man, and even though it was a shit game, you know, they did talk about the technical merits. I will say that the earlier systems, they definitely had a lot better things, a lot more interesting things. Even me, like, I grew up in that era. I knew everything they were saying. So as somebody who already knew all this, I still found it interesting to listen to. So somebody who had never heard it, like, I'm not totally shitting on it. I don't think people should not go to this, by no means. That's not what I'm saying. I found more holes in it than Swiss cheese, but there are some things that I did appreciate, like the way they talked about the programmers for the 2600 and just the way they talked about the games and that whole transition from the arcade to the home system. But I didn't like that on display at a museum that they didn't have an original Atari 2600 sitting there. They had a four-bank switch model, which was not an original. The original was a six-switch model. That's nitpicky nerdism right there, but I gotta throw it in because the 2600 is my thing.
You know what, Rick? I mean, what you're saying in a way parallels some of the discussions Brian and I have had since we went to the exhibition. Our discussions have centered around their choice of games to represent each genre within each era. But something I'm realizing when I think about those conversations in conjunction with what you just said is that it's such a broad area, mm-hmm. such a broad topic area, that there had to be a narrative to this this exhibition for it to be coherent and not just like a, here's everything ever made. Their narrative was very much arcades begat the home console, and you know what became of arcades after that really isn't our concern. Now we're here with the home console. And yeah, boy, there are so many directions they could have gone into. They really could have gone way more into the actual technical and artistic creativity that went into making the games. I think they were more trying to encapsulate...
I don't mean to interrupt, but there were things on the wall that, you know, we're talking about conversation, or I can't remember some of the titles, but basically you're looking at a big giant screen and it has a running loop of kind of like interviews, and they're cutting between people talking and showing clips of artwork or footage of a game and stuff like that. I think those areas could have been utilized much better by using that as a history lesson, or things that you really like they needed to tell an entire story of, because you could sit there and watch it for 10 minutes. Don't just rehash a 5-minute loop of what we just watched on all these other consoles. Because what they were doing was, well, Tom, why don't you explain to everybody what the whole place looked like?
Okay.
Like how they broke it down for the system, the year, and what it included. Because then I can explain my point better, I think.
Basically, I would say if you could draw a parallel between this exhibition and an experience you may have had, it would be history and appreciation of art before 1865, right? They basically walk you through its history and appreciation of video games from the 1970s to present. And they walk you through these various eras, those areas being the 1970s and 80s, which are called like the starting era. Then the next era, which is called the 8-bit era. Then what is colloquially called the 16-bit era, which they entitled Bit Wars, which is when, like, we have 16 bits. No, we're a 16-bit system. Like, I totally remember, like, all the marketing warfare that took place during this time between the different camps.
Okay, just to back up a little bit, the 8-bit era was labeled from 83 to 89, and the Bit Wars, or 16-bit era, was 89 to 94.
Right. It started popularly, at least when the Genesis was launched, although Brian and I know would argue that the TurboGrafx-16 actually started this era, mm-hmm. but it was conveniently not included in this era.
It was very weird to not see that there.
Yes, after the Bit Wars era, from which the venerable TurboGrafx-16 / PC Engine was unceremoniously omitted, they got into what they call the transition era, where curiously they decided to include Windows, or you know, PC gaming, which I recall having been around before that, but they, you know, I guess it, in terms of it being sort of a parallel to console gaming, I guess they decided that was when that period is when, I'm not actually sure why they decided then to include PC gaming, because I was PC gaming before this time.
That mm-hmm. seemed a little arbitrary.
Yeah. Yeah, they just kind of threw... I think, if I'm not mistaken, the dividing... They mentioned that Windows 95 was released, which I do remember being a pretty seminal moment in PC. You know, it may have been a period of wide adoption, because I remember a lot of people getting their first PC during that era.
Yeah, and then the games they focused on were like Doom 2 and StarCraft. I mean, it made sense with...
Yeah, all right.
When you really thought about it. I mean, when I first saw the Windows logo, I was like, what?
But
so
you know,
we can get to those.
Yeah. The computer as a gaming platform at that time was included alongside the Nintendo 64, the Sega Saturn, and the PlayStation, and I'm gonna take exception here, the Sega Dreamcast, which was after all of those systems and was a cut above them, and I think belonged in the next era.
Yeah.
Which is from the So that time period that I just mentioned spanned 95 to 2002. The next era was 2003 to current, and the Sega Dreamcast was at a minimum a bridge. that I think should have been included in the current era, but that's
it
just
would have easily competed with Xbox and PlayStation 2.
Yeah, like, it was a technically capable system. Thank you, Brian. Would have competed with Xbox and PlayStation 2, which were in this category. Really, it was everything from that point all the way up through GameCube and the 360, the Wii, and the PlayStation 3. So everything after the original PlayStation and Saturn all the way up to now, excluding the Dreamcast, which was lumped in with the PlayStation and Saturn.
So they had all these different eras, and they had the systems we were talking about listed in each one. So they actually had the system there, and then they had some artwork next to it and stuff, and a TV screen that had four big buttons under it, and one was called Target, one was Adventure, one was Action, and one was Tactics.
Those were the genres. Yes.
And those what those meant was completely arbitrary system to system.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, later on in the exhibit, you started, like, down the timeline, you started to see it being a little bit more focused and kind of the same things over and over. So I think it was a little loose at the beginning, but by the end it almost got too tight. So I think it made sense. It was one of the things, if they had to rein it in, I think those four sub-genres of games, I think that worked.
Metal Gear Solid 2 seems Liberty in the same category as Command & Conquer Red Alert in
or
2000.
Well, it's a tactics game, though.
Well, it's not really a real-time strategy game, though.
Well, guys, I think this is something we all wanted to get to. So we sort of talked about maybe the narrative being a little too narrow for our tastes, but that could have just been because they had to narrow it somewhat. Let's step through the genres and talk about what they chose each era and each system contained in that era and each genre as represented on each system during that era, and pick out those of note that we want to talk about. The first one, of course, was the Atari 2600 / why is it called the VCS, Rick? Can you give me a quick history rundown on why?
Video computer system.
That was.
They thought they could sell more if they called it the.
I always called it the 2600. I never knew it as the VCS. So yeah. That's puzzling to me. Anyway, for Target, they chose Space Invaders. Okay, it's a shooter. So we confirm there that Target is going to be like space shoot 'em ups, right?
Right. And I like the way they worked in the transition of how that, even though was visually different in a lot of ways than the true arcade version, the home market was more than pleased to have this as a home version. Even though it was different, all the mechanics, the sound, everything was still there. It still worked. It was one of the first all-time big blow-up successful video games. So I was happy to see that as a pick, for sure.
Yeah, okay. Brian, you agree? I mean, that wasn't a bad pick, Space Invaders.
Yeah, I like how they said that different is not necessarily worse.
Right.
Especially in the later consoles, if it was less than arcade perfect, everyone just hated it.
Right.
I appreciated that for context. People were at one point thrilled to have two pixels kicking around another pixel.
Correct. I mean, it was enough you could get a facsimile of what was available in the arcade, you know. So, okay, Space Invaders, good pick. The next genre for the 2600 was Adventure. And you know what game I was expecting to see as the pick? It was Adventure. But instead they chose Pitfall, which I would kind of consider to be more of an action game. But all right, it was an adventure. I mean, you were kind of in the role of Pitfall Harry. I don't know.
They had a weird thing here, because Adventure or Pitfall both work for two reasons. They're both adventure-y style games, and they're both extremely gigantic, groundbreaking games, which... They chose Pitfall, and they explained why it was a groundbreaking game. It was the first game where you had a running side-scrolling character. But that really sets up platforms, not adventure. Whereas Adventure was legitimately the first graphical adventure game that there ever was.
Right. That's my stance, basically. I view Pitfall as a proto-platformer.
Yes. So I agree with you on this one.
I really didn't read much about this going into it, so I was kind of a blank slate. And I think this is when I started to form an opinion that these were maybe artists talking about video games as opposed to video game people talking about the art of video games, because this kind of felt to me like that was a more popular game. That was a game like everybody knew and could connect to,
mm-hmm.
instead of the best suited game.
Well, I would point this out too, before, both in this case and as we go forward, there's a little crowdsourcing going on, because I believe these were put up to a vote. So I think the gaming public may have had some input here.
There were votes as to who was going to get into the list. I was actually part of that voting. It went on for a few months through the Smithsonian website.
So to Brian's point, the artists may have stepped in and decided. Okay.
Yep.
Well, they did put art in the title of the exhibition, so...
And, I mean, Brian's comment follows suit with my overall opinion of the whole thing. It seemed so arbitrary as to what was being picked, because some games are showcased as technological advancements, completely overlooking games that were visual technological advancements, and vice versa. So it was such a hodgepodge. It's like games you expected to see in places under these categories didn't show up. So there were some that were stuck in there, and you're like, why the hell is that there? And then others that were missing, and you're like, I can't believe that one wasn't there.
I'm going to jump forward a little bit on the timeline, too, because I have never in my life thought Saturn when I thought Tomb Raider.
Oh, yeah.
Right. What's the first game you think of when you fucking Saturn Knights, dude?
Yeah, actually...
For gameplay, for art, for everything.
Tomb Raider's not even on the list. I could go through 15 games before...
Yeah, I mean, when I think... We are jumping ahead, but when I think Saturn, I think of Clockwork Knight, one of the launch titles that was amazing. I think of Knights, which was that awesome 3D game with the analog controller.
Right, that's the first controller. It was the first 3D-ish looking... I mean, there was a lot of first-timers on that system. In that game alone, Saturn Knights.
Yeah, very bizarre choice there. Very bizarre choice, but... We'll get to some of these questionable choices. There are plenty to come. Action for the Atari 2600 was Pac-Man. Okay. It's an action game, I guess. And
really? No. Because it was pretty much, in the arcade, it was a genre-defining and genre-creating puzzle game.
That could have gone under the next category, then, which was Tactics, under which they put Combat, which I... It kind of was tactical, but it was also kind of a shooter. It was tactical in that you had military units, but you were just shooting balls at each other, right?
Ugh. More action-y than it was tactical.
Yeah.
The bouncing of the balls was very tactical.
See, like, I would say, like, Warlord or something would be more tactical than... Yeah. Although even that was kind of shooty.
Again, I mean, it was one of those games that everybody knows, and I mean, it really did make its mark. That was the first, for a lot of people, that was the first game, video game they ever played at their house that wasn't Pong. So I don't agree with it, but I think I see,
you can see
transparency
some
as to why it's there.
Okay. So let's pop to the next system, a system I had some experience with at a point. There came into my household over the course of about a year a ColecoVision. And I thought it was from the future. It was amazing. Weird button-y controllers and all. Okay, so for Target, they're consistent. They went with Zaxxon. Okay, so clearly we've established that Target is the genre under which, like, spaceship shooters go, right? In Adventure, Pitfall was for the 2600. Well, Pitfall 2, The Lost Caverns. Okay, all right, so Adventure. We're kind of a platformy slash story game. They did point out in the exhibition, though, that you could actually save your progress in Pitfall 2. So maybe that's kind of an adventure game feature, right? Like you're playing a Legend of Zelda type game, and here's, you save the game.
Yeah, and here's another one of those situations where they went with a technical advancement pretty much over anything else.
Right, checkpointing.
Most people, back in the day, ColecoVision, adventure game, one of the things you're going to think of is that stupid Smurf game. I mean... Pitfall
like
in any variation is a fucking Atari game. Let's just say it like it is.
Yeah.
So it was weird. Like, even me, like, I have Pitfall 2 for my ColecoVision, but that's still an Atari game, man. Like,
they did make an Atari Pitfall for the Nintendo Entertainment System, I want to point out.
Mm-hmm.
And
PC.
It was a game.
But I'm just saying, you know, it's like you want to familiarize people. You they should have went with a Coleco Beauty.
You know, actually, Smurfs was pretty solid. It looked great, I remember.
Much like they did for the action category. Donkey Kong. Don't think it's an action game, but...
Yeah, so Donkey Kong got the ColecoVision action game. I guess that's consistent with Pac-Man. So far, like, arcade ports seem to be taking the arcade, the action spots. And Tactics was Star Trek Strategic Operations Simulator. What little I remember about that game does strike me as tactical.
Yeah, I can't argue with that one. I would have liked to have seen Artillery Duel in there just because I felt it was more of an actual home console ColecoVision style game.
Yeah.
But again, that's just from my history of
it. That was one of the candidates was Artillery Duel. So, yeah. But Star Trek won out. All right. Moving on to Intellivision, a system with which I regrettably have no experience. In Target, again, they're consistent. They chose Star Strike, which was like basically a Death Star trench run shooter. Okay, I see where they're going with this.
Again, picked because of its technical merits. Where we saw in Pitfall, it had technical advancements in being able to save your game, save your spot, and stuff like that, as well as the multi-level, which was a new thing. Mm-hmm. And now, here in Star Strike, we have the fake 3D with the horizon and kind of like the different layers of graphics moving at different speeds.
Yeah, the Earth kind of coming into view as like a scrolling background. That was pretty slick, I admit.
Think Death Star Trench Run, which they actually talk about in game narration.
Yeah.
Yep. Or at the exhibit's narration for this game.
Okay, then we get into Adventure, and this is going to make me even wonder more why they didn't make Adventure the adventure game on the 2600. They chose Advanced Dungeons and Dragons. So they are kind of, now they're saying the adventure category goes to RPGs. RPGs like Pitfall. Pitfall 2. I think Adventure. I definitely think Legend of Zelda, action RPGs, that kind of thing.
Have any of you guys played the Advanced Dungeons and Dragons game?
No, I never got that one.
For Intellivision? So not playing it and then watching their little video of it, what were your thoughts on it?
It looked amazing.
It looked like kind of a RPG, like an early RPG to me, from what I could see.
Yeah. I just wanted like a first-hand, like I have first-hand experience in it, so to hear... And, like, me seeing it again, I was like, God damn. Like, it brought back out this flood of memories. Like, I always say to you guys that I missed out on the whole D&D experience of being able to play legitimate with dice and paper and everything. But I did have the Advanced Dungeons & Dragons Intellivision experience 1,000% with my buddies all sitting around at sleepovers playing this on our friends' Intellivision on the big TV set. So
you're lucky.
Brought back all those fake campaign memories. Like, I was blown away. I didn't realize all that was like left inside me. I totally have forgotten about it.
You're the most fortunate among us, Rick, in that Brian and I were like a little too young to fully appreciate the first era they discuss here. Though we were alive during it, we experienced it. You got to experience it as a thinking being, whereas we were like little half monkey like kids, you know. So I am envious that you actually remember that.
Yeah, I was like 14.
Oh man, you were in it. You were living it. So Advanced Dungeons and Dragons, okay, adventure games. We're definitely going in an RPG-y type of direction. Okay. Let's now move on to action. And in action, they put in a game called Tron Mazatron.
Mm-hmm.
You play it ever?
Yeah, I have it.
Okay.
It's that
was a stupid question, wasn't it?
Yeah, do you have anything? Are you missing anything Tron related collection? No. Okay.
This game is about as much Tron related as, man, I don't even have a comparison.
They just seem similar to Advanced Dungeons and Dragons to me.
They slapped a name on it that said Tron and made it inside of a computer. That was about the extent of it.
Yeah, weren't you like infiltrating a microchip or something?
Yeah. Yeah, okay. There actually was another Tron game that had recognizers and stuff in it, and of course discs of Tron and stuff like that. I think the Microsurgeon for that might, nah, maybe not. They're all kind of the same.
So
I don't know. That I thought that was a weird pick. Cool to see that game on screen again, and remember how awkward it was to play it because it really made no sense. It was almost like the E.T. of the Intellivision.
Oh dear.
was just one of those weird games. Really kind of just made no sense. You bought it because it was Tron, and when you played it, you're like, this ain't fucking Tron.
This ain't Tron. This is a nightmare.
Right? It's a nightmare inside of a computer. This could be anything. This could be JoJo's Find the Bit adventure. Who knew?
I note that Masters of the Universe, The Power of He-Man, was a candidate. I played some Masters of the Universe game on one of the more advanced Atari systems. I don't know if it was the 5200 or the 7600. I remember it being a decent game and being really impressed with the fact that it actually said, by the power of Grayskull, when you started it up or something like that. So if that was it, then that was impressive. If that wasn't it, then I apologize. Tactics. On to Tactics. Now here they chose Utopia, a sort of world domination slash management game, right?
Uh-huh.
That seems to fit under Tactics, so that's the direction they're going now, right? It's no combat, but...
Right, it's just so odd, because they could have stuck with a theme like they did with the other ones, and had gone much like Tank or whatever. Like, B-17 Bomber was one of the first talking games.
Yes, I think B-17 Bomber was the extent of the dialogue. But...
Right, and, but... So rather than going with the technological advance here, I think they went with the genre-defining, quote-unquote, tactics-style game with Utopia, which is a lot like, what, SimCity and stuff like that?
On like a world scale, it seems. Yeah, yeah. I guess you didn't really have that option on the 2600, so they put into Tactics what was available at the time, you know? Yeah. So, okay, I mean, I don't want to sound like we're just being pricks. They fit into those categories, those things which they could.
They were planning for the future.
Yeah. Yes, that's exactly what I was trying to say, Brian. It seems like they made the choice here to set up what the tactics category will be by the end of the exhibit.
Yeah, okay. Okay, cool. I like where we're going with this. I like the narrative we're stamping on this exhibition, so good. Okay, that brings us to the next era, which is when I know Brian and I kind of came into our own as little gaming monsters. You know, we were... old enough to start like asking, like bothering our parents for titles and like having opinions and telling our friends which games sucked and were awesome. That being the 8-bit era, 1983 to 89. Regrettably, my experience with the Commodore 64 is nil, other than playing it at my friend's house a couple times. So I might need some heavy input from either of you two guys if you had experience.
I still have my original.
Okay, Brian, you a big Commodore 64 guy?
Not so much experience. Played at a buddy's house.
Okay, we will rely heavily on Rick during this. I will say one thing before we get into the first genre, which is Target. Raid on Bungling Bay was a candidate, and I played the first game I ever played on the Nintendo Entertainment System was a port of that game, and I thought it was awesome. It was a cool helicopter game. You took off from an aircraft carrier and did missions.
Nice.
But that said, the winner was Attack of the Mutant Camels, which looks suspiciously like Empire Strikes Back to me,
which
for the 2600.
Which they do acknowledge in the dialogue for the little movie that went along with it.
I did play 2600 Empire Strikes Back, which looked basically like the same game. Target, I mean, I guess that fits. That's a shooter, right? That's a space shooter. That's a desert shooter against mutant camels.
Yeah. I don't know. I never played it. It looked weird, though.
It looked like the 26. I mean,
I don't think it was a great representation graphically for a game of the Commodore 64, but, you know, whatever. It was definitely a parody of the Empire Strikes Back game, so.
Yeah, it was. It looked like mechanically it was that game, except the AT-ATs had big necks and humps, so.
I kind of felt like 4chan got a hold of the voting on this one.
Yeah.
That's a little weird.
I wouldn't rule that out.
So, okay. Attack of the Mutant Camels. It's a shooter. In the adventure genre, Bard's Tale 3, Thief of Fate. Opinions? I thought Bard's Tale was an RPG series for some reason.
So
did I. They don't have an RPG section, so... I guess, where else would you put it? It's not tactics, it's not action.
Okay, so...
I'm less offended by that than I am some of the others.
I kind of want RPGs under adventure, so I'm okay with that. I'm okay with this choice, based on what little I know of Bard's Tale. In the action genre, a game called Jumpman, which was appeared to me to be sort of a Donkey Kong inspired game where you climb ladders and stuff. Rick, am I off base on that?
No, that's basically what it was. They also have listed on here during that same era a game called Impossible Mission. I played pretty much less than a handful of games on my Commodore. I used to program my own games on it. That was my interest in it. But one of the four or five games that I've actually ever played on the Commodore, one of them was Impossible Mission. That game was to platforming what Donkey Kong was to an arcade game, dude.
Oh, wow.
I'm so blown away that that was not what they chose. You jump around from platform to platform, and you gotta, like, find, like, keys, like, data key cards to shut down computers that stop robots and all kinds of stuff like that. It was such a badass game. And graphically, 100 times deeper, so I don't know why it would have been chosen by the art community. Or not been chosen by the art community. So, yeah. I mean, this one is just one of those ones I can't wrap my head around. Because it fits the title, it fits the system, and it would have fit the art criteria. It blows me away why it's not there.
Hmm. Interesting commentary, Rick. Thanks for your insight on that. I wish I had more to offer. That brings us over to tactics. I just want to say one thing on this category. One, I am familiar with Sid Meier's, or Meier's, however you pronounce that, Pirates, because I played a port of that on the NES. But before we get into that, if you haven't yet, guys, click on the link for MULE, or Mule, one of the candidates for this category, and tell me if you're not seeing a trend in graphics here when that Wikipedia link pops up.
Yeah, this one I do know about, and we're seeing yet another AT-AT.
Well, yeah, why is the 2600 AT-AT making such a prominent appearance in these Commodore 64 games?
No idea, man.
Yeah, so thoughts on Sid Meier's Pirates being a tactics game?
Where else would it fit, I guess? I think that's what it came down to. I think they decided on these four categories based on some really good opportunities, and then they shoehorned the stuff into fit because, I mean, what tactics were there in Pirates at all?
Didn't you have to choose whether or not to attack certain ships or something based on the possible risk reward? I mean, this is, I'm just, that could have been one of a dozen other games I played. I'm just trying to remember.
I mean, you knew roughly how powerful the ship was, so you wouldn't attack a huge vessel if you didn't have the ship to take it,
but didn't,
I don't
this
know,
ship,
is that really a tactic?
Didn't it jump around, though? It's weird. I agree with you that it's kind of used loosely, but you did manage things, so if you kind of looked at it as the tactics is like managing stuff, maybe it works better.
Yeah, I mean, your crew would get pissed off and leave you if you didn't fight enough, and if you didn't like share the loot enough, and
so it should be tactics / management.
So why didn't, like, wasn't there a version of Oregon Trail for the Commodore 64? Because that should have made the cut too. I mean,
yeah, that's true.
If you spent all your time hunting like I did, being like, you know, a 7-year-old, then you died. Your people died.
That would have been a good pick, I think, Tom.
Oregon Trail?
Yeah.
Nice. Oregon Trail. We'll call it Oregon Trail 64, not to be confused with the Nintendo 64 version to come later.
Hey, before we move on, I do want to say, in the action category, if anybody wants to check out that Impossible Mission, they do have a port that you can pick up super cheap for your 3D, for your Nintendo DS.
Oh,
cool.
I may check that out. That might sway my opinion.
I have it, and it's pretty spot on.
Nice. Okay, so moving away from the Commodore 64, we jump into the Nintendo Entertainment System, the far and away leader of the, although not necessarily the technically best system, of the 8-bit era, at least here in the U.S. For Target, 1943, Battle of Midway. It's a shooter. That's a horizontal, I'm sorry, vertical, I should say. What's the one where you're looking down at it, Brian, and you're going up the screen? Vertical, right?
Top view vertical.
Yeah, top view vertical shoot 'em up. Space, you know, airplane shooter where you're taking down the evil Axis fleet as a, what is it? What was that plane called? P-35 or whatever.
P-41 Lightning or something.
P-40, yeah, P something or other. The plane with like the, that looks like it has two fuselages, basically. Pretty cool. Pretty cool game. It's a shooter. I'm happy with that. I would have been happier with Life Force, also known some relation to Gradius, if I'm not mistaken, Brian, on Life Force. That was another candidate.
Yeah. I enjoyed the 1940X series, but I never knew they were popular or groundbreaking. I'm surprised to see it included.
It was sort of a continuation on like the Space Invaders theme, really, in that you were looking down at the playfield, and I guess it was more popular than we ever thought. I didn't know it was that wild.
I'm pleased.
Yeah, decent stuff. That takes us on to Adventure, where I cannot argue with their choice in The Legend of Zelda. That is a quintessential. That's like the quintessential adventure game to me. That is the spiritual successor to Adventure, which was, in my opinion, the rightful winner of that category for the 2600.
Mm, I agree with you on that.
Of note, they had according to the Wikipedia listing, Final Fantasy and Shadowgate were also listed as adventure games.
Now, Shadowgate was a brilliant game. It was the farthest thing from adventure as you could possibly get.
It was text. It was like text-based, right?
I mean, yeah, it was.
It had images. Yeah, I guess it would be called a text-based adventure game, but I wouldn't. I mean, I guess it's more in the vein of Zork or something, isn't it? Like,
yeah.
Yeah. So.
Zork with a GUI.
if Legend of Zelda hadn't been picked in this category, I would have been kind of surprised. So I'm glad that made. I'm glad I'm not often completely in left field here.
I probably would have pissed on the fucking podium and walked out. And I'm not even a giant fan of it. I just would have been like, this is ridiculous, I'm out of here.
Yeah, they would have been way off the mark. Okay, that brings us to action. And Super Mario Brothers 3 won in the action category. So,
why? Why not the first one?
And
I'm questioning, like, I don't understand. Like, I'm not a big Nintendo guy, so this is a legit...
I guess
I want insight as to why not.
If you look at Super Mario Brothers 3 stacked against the original Super Mario Brothers, when you were getting toward the end of the NES's life cycle, mm-hmm. You didn't think they could pull any more out of it, and Super Mario Brothers 3 stood head and shoulders above other Mario games. Even the port of another game that became Super Mario Brothers 2, Super Mario Brothers 3 was just an amazing game and added a lot of different modes for Mario too, I think, right?
Since they have to take all of them as one era, I guess I can kind of forgive that, but I don't see how you can, talking about the history of something, get to 3 without acknowledging 1.
Yeah, 1 was kind of, I mean, 1 put Nintendo on the map, to be truthful. In terms of its impact, I would say 1 was much greater. It had a much greater impact as a game than 3.
But...
to what I said earlier, I think Super Mario 3 was more artistic, so I guess I should kind of like that.
It was, aesthetically, it was just gorgeous, and still looks great. So yeah, I guess.
Well, it was also the it wasn't necessarily like just a story in the game. It had that whole like this is a play being put on game within a game kind of.
That's right. The curtain would like drop and stuff, wasn't it?
Yeah, and you'd walk off stage. With like the little black and white at the end, and
yeah, it was a well presented game. It really was.
So and maybe it's more artistic than 1.
It was the best the Nintendo Entertainment System had to offer in all when it came to sound, graphics, you know, anything like that. So from a look and feel standpoint, yeah, I could see why they picked it. But yeah, why not 1, which kind of defined the action platformer of the 8-bit era.
Because there were better-looking Zelda games on the NES than The Legend of Zelda, weren't there? Or
they only one after that was Link's The Adventure of Link, which was the side scroller. It looked better, but it was to say that it was a better game would be a bit of a stretch.
It's the art of video gaming. So I'm trying to throw logic in.
No, you make sense. If they chose Legend of Zelda, it stands to reason they would then choose Super Mario Brothers as the action game, but they went with Mario 3. So.
Mm. So interesting. Not criticizing it, just interesting.
Yeah, interesting, right. Tactics. Desert Commander. I was a pretty avid NES gamer, and I don't ever remember Desert Commander.
First thing Kimberly said was, I can't believe you've never played that. I'm like, I know, right? totally looked like a Rick game.
It looks. I mean, when I was watching it, I was like, how did I miss this? It looked good.
I can't believe we're unanimous on this. I've never played it either.
Yeah. I can't really argue with it because what I saw of it looked cool and it looked like a definite, like, what I consider like a military tactics game.
Yep.
So I cannot, it looked like a predecessor. a precursor to something like an Advance Wars.
Yes, that, dude, that's exactly what I said. That's exactly what I said.
So, yeah, I cannot argue with that. I can't. I think that pick was good. Yeah, I should just move on before I don't want to offend them by saying anything but good about their choice here, because it seemed like a solid one. They pulled something I didn't even know about. So it must be good. All right, that brings us to the loser of the 8-bit era, but not for technical reasons, because it was a great system, the Sega Master System. Technically superior to the NES, but they lost the marketing battle / did not get monopoly rights to a bunch of titles like Nintendo did. Mm-hmm. Nintendo was later successfully sued, if I'm not mistaken, for that. If I'm wrong, please, Nintendo, do not sue me for libels or misrepresentation of the facts. Just shooting from the hip. And I love you. I love Nintendo and Sega. I love everyone. Target. They pull out Afterburner, which was a port of the groundbreaking arcade game, which didn't exist because in this universe, arcades are non-existent at this point.
I thought it was weird they didn't mention that, but go ahead.
Afterburner was actually, for the technology available on the Sega Master System, a very impressive port of what at the time was a cutting-edge arcade game. Maybe it occurred a year or two after the game came out in the arcade, I couldn't tell you for sure, but I thought that was a pretty... It was a decent enough choice for Target. Brian, I've got one other candidate that didn't even make their list, but Brian, what do you think about Afterburner? I know
Choplifter would be the only other thing. That was, I mean, as much as I liked the game, Afterburner was way more impressive, so I can forgive that.
I'm surprised Choplifter didn't make the list, but yeah, I'm not bummed about Afterburner. It was a very solid port, considering. Just a quick personal story. I had a friend of mine who lied all school year about having a Master System and how awesome it was. And that summer, he said if I came over, he'd finally let me play it. So I was going to go over his house, and I was going to play Afterburner. And then he had to come clean and say he never owned a Master System.
Oh.
It was heartbreaking. He lied to me all school year, stringing me along, keeping me as his friend. A jerk. Afterburner. I hate that guy. That takes us over to Adventure, which is the home of RPGs and action RPGs and Pitfall, apparently, because we have Phantasy Star, a full-on RPG, and that's where RPGs belong in the adventure genre. Do you guys disagree? Phantasy Star was an excellent game.
You played it?
Yeah, oh yeah. Yeah,
the game fucking ruled, man.
Yeah.
I believe you can get the entire Phantasy Star series on Xbox now through Live. Mm-hmm.
I'm going to have to figure out how to link this this crazy video I have. I was really crazy super into Phantasy Star and the Saturn, and they did a Millennium Edition for the Saturn in Japan, nice. And I imported it. And one of the things they had was an ad, like a television ad for one of the games. And it's so incredibly cheesy and so very Japanese. It's rattling on about all of the screens and it's showing you fighting. And then they just shout, King of RPG!
We have to, that has to get linked in there. If we have access to a video like that online, that's got to be in the show notes for this episode. I do remember the King of RPG exclamation. Hard to argue with Phantasy Star, man. I think that was a... I'm totally happy with their choice there.
And agreed.
Agree that adventure is RPGs, I'm happy with it.
We kind of have to, because adventure's kind of all-encompassing, and you are on an adventure. Although there were quite a few candidates I could have thought of for the Master System, not least of which were Ys.
That's more adventure-y to me.
Yeah, and it is an adventure. Yeah, and it would have fit into adventure. And I want to say Zillion. Do you remember that, like, side-scrolling space, pew-pew-pew, like, shooter type game?
Oh, Govelius.
What was Govelius?
Delta clone.
Oh, no. No, I don't remember that. That would have fit. I guess they didn't want to retread ground that had already been covered by Zelda, so didn't make it. Heroes of the Lance made the list, though. Was that a Dragonlance game? Yes.
I don't remember.
Just based on that, it should have won. No, it shouldn't have. I have no idea how good or bad that game was.
It is a Dragonlance game.
Well, that makes me love it. On to action, where they really went off the rails. This is one of those, like, they didn't choose an exclusive game, and they didn't choose a game that I thought was, that had characteristics of being a genre beater. They chose Marble Madness.
So which... fucking odd, man. Why? I mean, why?
I mean, I can look at the other two candidates were Shinobi and Land of Illusion starring Mickey Mouse, either of which, I mean, Shinobi especially, could have won. And I can pull out another candidate it's a little known fact that toward the end of the Sega Master System's lifetime, they did a Sonic the Hedgehog game for it, which might have been a backport from the Genesis for all I know, but that was pretty iconic on that system for action.
Well, this was another one of those ones that it seems like they picked for groundbreaking reasons, graphically. But
why not the NES version then? Because it did look better on the Master System, but the same game came out on the NES, and I played it.
You know what, dude? I was really surprised to even see this here because my home console familiarity, that's even a word, of Marble Madness was NES.
Yeah.
Not Sega Master System. The Master System, that was the last thing that would come to my mind, especially for action game.
I didn't know it existed.
Shinobi! Like, that's just...
Yeah, Shinobi, when you think early Sega games, Shinobi was, like, definitely...
Yeah, that was a weird one. I think they did the next one, but...
Yes.
Go ahead, Brian, sorry.
I was going to say, I think they did a pretty good job defending their choice in the video.
Yes.
But not for Master System.
Yeah, I think I felt like I was confused. I watched, I listened, I was convinced until the video was over that I'm like, wait a minute, you're not going to fucking bullshit and brainwash me. This is still wrong. I believed it for half a second.
Yeah, so Marble Madness, that's a disagree. I don't see how that was iconic for the Genesis. And it was more of a puzzle. I guess it was action.
Master
I don't know.
System, isn't it?
I don't know.
Yeah, did I say Genesis? I meant to say Master System. If I said Genesis, I apologize. I do make that mistake, even though I know that the Master System was its own unique and wonderful console. Okay, speaking of games that define the Sega Master System and their genre, brace yourselves for this choice, Spy versus Spy.
That's right, ladies and gentlemen, Mad Magazine's Spy versus Spy.
Mad Magazine's appropriations of some Cuban, like, comic satirist's Sunday strip, Spy versus Spy.
Now, didn't they also have a Spy versus Spy on NES?
Yeah. So it wasn't an exclusive, and I would hardly call it... Was it a tactics game in the traditional sense?
No, okay, not when you're looking at some other choices, like Rampart, let's say, which is a full-blown tactics game in every sense of the definition. I mean, it's perfect. And visually, it looks 1,000 times better. So this is another one, much like the one we just were talking about, that makes no sense. Why did they pick it? Illogical. I can't draw two connecting lines for this to make sense anywhere.
Yeah, I don't understand their choice here. I mean, Brian, you did own a Master System. Can you think? I mean, obviously Rampart, which was also not an exclusive. Can you think of another candidate that would have better?
Not really. I was playing mostly RPGs on it.
Yeah.
But I will say I was a pretty avid Sega Master System player and I didn't know the game existed. So that kind of makes me feel like maybe it is a bad choice.
Yeah. I have a system too, and I have no clue as to what... I never saw that game.
Yeah, all right. Well, who are we to argue? We couldn't come up with anything better, so Spy versus Spy it is.
Rampart's better. There, I just solved it.
Well, at this point, we're going to go ahead and stop our tour of the museum. This has been a pretty lengthy episode because we all had a lot to say about all the games we saw at the Art of Video Games exhibition. With our resident editor, Rick, out, it's fallen to Brian and I to handle the editing, and hopefully we will do a great job with that. That said, it also falls to us to do our customary housekeeping. I'll start off by letting you know that any of our refined listeners are encouraged to head over to iTunes and subscribe to our podcast, as well as to rate it as many stars as humanly possible.
We invite you to join us on Facebook. We've got a page for you to like and a group for you to join. All kinds of little extras in between episodes. Get to know us a little bit better. Make suggestions.
And as Rick always mentions, if you're not into iTunes or Facebook, or even if you're into both and want another way to consume the Nerdstravaganza, swing on over to nerdstravaganza.com and you can listen to our show, rate the show, and check out our pretty graphics. And as well, feel free to shoot us an email at nerdstravaganza@gmail.com. We welcome your feedback and we'd love to know what you think of the Art of Video Games exhibition. And with that said,
peace!
Nice.
Yeah, I don't
Maze
really,
Game.
But
I
mean, that wasn't
Maze
a category.
Maze Game. Maze Game.
Okay, Maze Game.